ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Saul Eslake is one of Australia's most well-known and respected economists. Saul's career has been driven by curiosity, critical thinking, and a willingness to go wherever the data leads him into the mysterious beast that is the global economy. But over the last 20 years, Saul's used these same skills to unravel his own personal mystery. In the early 2000s, Saul and his wife brought home their first adopted daughter, which was a moment of great joy for them. But it was then that it really hit home for Saul Eslake that he'd never met any of his blood relatives, because he too had been adopted at the age of one from a birth mother he knew nothing about, in circumstances that were also completely unknown to him. So Saul did what Saul does. He went where the data led him, to England, to a newspaper scandal, and then at last to the family story he never knew. Hello, Saul. Welcome back.
It's nice to be with you again, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Now, we know you were born in England. Do you have any memories of that life at all? Any pictures in your head?
Oh, yes. I lived in England until I was just over 8 years old. My first memory is actually of flying out to Australia when I think I was almost five with my mother and two of my adoptive siblings to go and visit my grandparents, my mother's parents, who lived in Sydney. I remember we flew in a 707 via New York, San Francisco, Honolulu, Nandi in Fiji, and then to Sydney. We stopped in a hotel at San Francisco Airport, where for the first time I saw colour TV. And I looked out the window and saw more cars in the airport car park than I had ever seen in my life. And those two memories stick with me, as do some of the things we did in Sydney on the ground, meeting some other relatives of my mother's family that I'd never met before. And I remember the house in which we lived when I was about 8 years old, when my parents had decided to return to Australia, and we wound up in the little town in the far northwest corner of Tasmania.
These were your Australian adoptive parents.
That's right.
What kind of background did they come from?
Well, my parents grew up in Sydney, my mother in Leichhardt and my father in Balmain, when they were suburbs that you wouldn't live in if you had any choice about it. They were not fashionable, trendy suburbs as they were now. My father's father had served in the First World War. He was at Gallipoli, not in the first landing, but in the second one, and then on the Western Front. I think he was scarred by some of what he experienced, although he never talked about it to my father or his older brother. But he drove a truck. My grandmother worked in a boot factory during the Great Depression. They never owned a home. They rented a home in Balmain. My mother's father was an Anglican priest whose family originally came from Wollongong, but he was the rector of All Souls Church in Leichhardt until the late 1960s, when he eventually retired. My father was the first Eslake ever to go to university. He became a dentist, and he went to England with my mum the day after they got married, because there were plenty of jobs for dentists in Britain, dentistry having been put on the National Health Scheme by the post-war Labor government, as opposed to there not being so many jobs apparently for dentists in Australia. So they were in England for the best part of 15 years. During that time, they adopted four children, of whom I was the first. And as I understand it, eventually they decided they didn't want their children to grow up as POMs. They wanted to go back to Australia. And they wound up, as I say, in a small town of about 4,000 people in the far northwest of Tasmania, which for two people who'd grown up in Sydney in the 1920s, 30s and early 40s, when Sydney was a big city of over a million, and then for the next 15 years lived in London, to find themselves in a town of 4,000 in the far northwest corner of Tasmania must have been something of a culture shock for them. But they did like it. And when my father eventually retired, they moved back to an even more remote part of the far northwest coast of Tasmania and lived there very happily for most of the remainder of their lives.
Were you a close family?
Yes, although my parents, that is my adoptive parents, were reflecting their heritage, were not especially demonstrative in a kind of physical way. They were not the kind of people who would routinely and regularly profess or talk about deep emotions. That wasn't their style. But there's absolutely no doubt that they were as devoted to the four children they had adopted as any biological parents would be. And they provided all of us with a stable, loving environment. They managed to get all of us through tertiary education. All four of us ended up with university degrees. And yeah, we always had a place that we could return to that was called home.
Were they able to tell you much at all about your biological mother and father as you were growing up?
All I was ever told was that I was given the name Richard at birth, and all of us except my younger sister have as our middle names the names we were given at birth. I recall my parents telling me that my biological father had been a university graduate. I don't think they ever told me anything that I can remember about my biological mother other than that she wasn't married to my biological father. As it turned out, they knew a little bit more than they ever told me, but they didn't really know a great deal. And of course, in those days, adoption meant the severance of whatever relationship you as a baby might have had with either or both of your biological parents, and it meant the same thing in reverse as well. My biological parents would no doubt have been told to forget that this had ever happened and get on with the rest of their lives, which both of them did.
So you knew you had been adopted at the age of 1 year or thereabouts, not 1 month, but 1 year. What did you think about that?
Well, I knew that I was adopted because my parents had told me that. And when they adopted the youngest of my three adoptive siblings, I was seven. So, you know, I pretty well knew what was going on. You know, I can remember going along to the family court at which the judge approved my parents' application to adopt my younger sister. And for quite some time after that, having observed that process, I thought that's where babies came from. My parents never really talked much about the facts of life as they were.
No, because babies come from a courtroom. Is that what?
from an adoption agency. So, you know, we all knew we were adopted. Yeah. I'm not sure when I found out that I had been adopted at the age of about one, other than that I remember my parents for some reason giving me my birth certificate alongside an adoption certificate. And so that said that I was born in January 1958, but adopted in February 1959. And I wondered to myself, knowing that my younger siblings had all been adopted when they were a matter of months, if that old, you know, how come I hadn't been adopted until I was one? And for quite some time, and you know, this I must have been 8, 9, 10, 11, something like that, I thought, you know, maybe I was in an orphanage somewhere and prospective adoptive parents would walk past and think, no, I don't want that one, and move on to something else. And kind of wondered about that. You know, was it because I'd worn glasses since I was four? So did I have squinty eyes that made me a less appealing prospect for prospective adoptive parents? I don't know.
Yep. Does that mean, though, that you, since you came up with these theories, then did you sort of carry a sense of, I don't know, rejection with you because of that theory you had in your head?
No, I'm not sure that I'd describe it as rejection. It was just I'd wondered whether there had been something wrong. And, you know, I might have been 10 or 11 or something like that at the time. There was a song, it was a cover of an earlier version of a song called Nobody's Child. And that song was supposedly a kid who was blind, who had been in an orphanage for a long time, and that when prospective adoptive parents saw that he was blind, he was passed over. You know, I think the song said they turned and picked some other kid and I am left behind. And, you know, while that obviously wasn't me, I sort of felt a bit of an affinity with whoever the child depicted in that song was, even though, as I say, my situation was nothing really quite like his. Kind of, I suppose, in a sense, is part of what I was as a preteen and a teenager, and subsequently found out that the situation was nothing like what I had imagined it to be.
Did you and your siblings ever talk about one day meeting your respective biological parents?
No. I think all of us in different ways felt that, as I gather quite a lot of other adopted people do, if their adoptions have been successful as ours were, that it somehow might seem ungrateful or disrespectful to our parents, our adoptive parents, to kind of explore whether anybody else was involved in our being on this earth. And so while I personally thought about it, I had for a long time said to myself, well, I might look this up one day, but I won't do it while my parents are still alive. And while since then my youngest sibling has traced her biological mother and met her, the middle two haven't expressed any interest in doing that at all. And that, I think that reflects the real world, that some adopted people want to know, others don't.
So as you say, Saul, you and your siblings went to university. Were you always going to be an economist?
No. That was a process of elimination for me. So, you know, I was through school pretty good at academic subjects, hopeless at sport, which didn't make my life easier in an all-boys school where being good at sport was something to be admired and being good at your studies fell into a different category. I didn't want to do the things that so-called bright kids were meant to want to do, like law or medicine. That might have been born out of an irrational fear of self-employment or for some other reasons, but they just didn't appeal to me. I was a year younger than all of my cohort, and so I finished year 12 before my 17th birthday. I didn't feel like I wanted to go to the mainland to university at that age, which ruled out a whole lot of things that you couldn't study at the University of Tasmania in those days, like dentistry, veterinary studies, ironically, forestry. In some ways, I might have been interested in doing the subjects I enjoyed most in senior high school, like history and geography, but it was hard to see where that would lead to career-wise. So it sort of came down to a choice between engineering and commerce. And I didn't do engineering partly because you needed to be really good at maths to do well at engineering. And while I'd passed maths in year 11 and 12, it wasn't my best subject. And the other reason, ironically, was that someone to whom I had come second in every year since the first year of high school was doing engineering. And I just felt I couldn't take another 4 years of coming home at the end of the year and my father asking, did you beat this guy this year? And so I enrolled in commerce, assuming that I'd end up being an accountant. You know, I knew what accountants did. That led to a job. You had to do some economic subjects as well as accounting subjects in first year in those days. And I found the economic subjects much more interesting than the accounting ones. They also intersected to some extent with politics, which I also at that stage found pretty interesting. So I switched my major, and during third year, I got a cadetship from the Federal Treasury to allow me to do fourth year, which provided a job at the end of it. So that provided the answer to the question, well, what are you going to do with that degree? And it all went from there. And I have absolutely no regrets about it. You know, I'm really glad that that's what I decided to do.
I think, Saul, there are economists who go into it because they want to make money, they like money. But there are others who go into economics who love tracking down the data points, assembling the hard facts of data points, bringing them together and seeing what true picture emerges. Are you one of those economists?
Well, yes, that's something I certainly like doing, is trying to find data that helps you make sense of the way in which the world and the country in which you happen to live, or the country that you're looking at, how it works and what that means. But it's not the only thing about economics that motivates me. There was a Nobel Prize winning economist, Jacob Viner, who said he studied economics because it carried the possibility that good policy could improve the lot of mankind. And I've always been interested in economic policy and in how the levers that governments and central banks can pull, whether it's interest rates or tax policy measures, trade policy measures, different types of government spending, can solve problems and make people's lives better. That's something that's always interested me as well. So to a greater extent than a lot of other people who've had careers similar to mine, I've wanted to think about and write and say things about economic policy, both criticising bad economic policies when I see them and advocating for better economic policies if I can.
So just fast-forwarding through your illustrious career, you worked for some years in the public sphere, then went into the private sector. Eventually, you rose up to become the chief economist at ANZ Bank and then went to the Bank of America / Merrill Lynch. So if we fast-forward to the 2000s now, you and your wife had adopted two children yourself. Your daughter had been living in an orphanage in China. Can you tell me what it was like going there to pick her up and what you remember of that day?
Well, she was born in Shenyang, which is in the northeast of China, in Liaoning province, in, I suppose, what many people will know as Manchuria. At the time, it was a city of about 7 million people, very industrial in what I suppose you would call China's Rust Belt. It was the original home of the Qing or Manchu dynasty that ruled China between 1644 and 1911. So it had its own version of a forbidden city. It also had what people claimed was the biggest statue of Chairman Mao in the whole of China. I don't know whether that's true or not, but we saw the statue and it was certainly very big. It was March 2004, so it was still bitterly cold. And I think Westerners were, you know, not a common sight around that place. So I had been to China before then, but it was a different experience. We were taken to the orphanage where Caroline had spent her first 2 years. She had lived for most of that time in a room with about 20 other infants of a similar age and with one carer or IE in the room, you know, obviously rotating through the time. They were fed in a sort of mechanistic way. They had congee for every meal. They were rarely spoken to. So Caroline obviously didn't have any English. She didn't have a great deal of Mandarin either. She really was, in that sense, speech delayed. She was physically well cared for. You know, the Australian government required her to have lots of medical checks to ensure that she'd had the appropriate number of vaccinations and things like that before she'd be let into the country. And with one exception, she had had all the vaccinations that a similarly aged kid in Australia would have had by that stage. But she had been emotionally deprived. She hadn't had a great deal of warmth in her life up to that point, and that obviously leave scars which take some time to heal. There was an awful lot of bureaucracy you had to go to get photographs taken at the police station, to sign documents written in Chinese, to get them translated, to put your thumbprint on them with red ink, all that sort of stuff. But you know, the Chinese authorities at the time were going to considerable lengths to ensure that the children who were put up for adoption were genuinely abandoned by whoever their biological mother, father, or parents were, that they hadn't been stolen, that they weren't being trafficked, and that they actually were who the authorities said they were. And, you know, I respect that and appreciate it.
Once you brought Caroline home, how did that get you thinking about your own family history?
Well, it occurred to me that all of my adoptive siblings, my younger sisters and my younger brother, had biological children of their own. And it occurred to me that as someone who was both an adoptee and an adoptive parent, which I think is a fairly unusual combination, I would never meet anyone carrying the same genes as me unless I found them. And although my adoptive parents were still alive at that stage, and as I said before, I had thought they might consider it disrespectful or ungrateful if I went looking for biological relatives. Nonetheless, I thought, well, you know, given their likely age, I'd better do it sooner rather than later. So I started doing it. And I sort of knew what to do because I had previously in the 1980s, along with an aunt and another cousin, done quite a bit of research into my adoptive family in particular. I knew what agencies to approach, how to get birth certificates, how to trace relatives once you had birth, marriage, death certificates. And so, you know, that wasn't a difficult task. The unusual step, I suppose, having obtained my original birth certificate and seen what my name, Richard Kimberley, was at birth, then to find the successor to the agency through which I and my three siblings had been adopted. That was in London, of course, had to find them, write to them, ask, you know, what records did they have, and then take the process from there.
The birth certificate said that you were born with the name Richard Kimberley, and Richard, of course, is a fine name. Saul, I'm very disappointed you've walked away, forced to walk away from that. Who did it list as your mother, the name of your mother, and what was the name listed as your father?
Well, it listed Margaret Jean Kimberley as my mother, and it listed Albert William Kimberley as my father.
And what happened when you got hold of your adoption file?
I found the successor to the agency through which I'd been adopted. That was originally called the Church Adoption Society, because churches played quite a role in the 1950s and 60s in facilitating, if that's the right word, adoptions. And this was an agency that was now called ChildLink, whose function had evolved into helping relinquishing parents find their birth children and people in positions like mine, adopted children, find their biological relatives, their birth parents and siblings. So that's what they did. So
it had evolved from an agency that was trying to hold everyone at a distance to an agency that was trying to connect people instead.
Yes. They said that they had a file, that they had all of the records around my adoption, and their policy was that they would give me that file, but they would give it to me via a government-approved social worker. So I was living in Melbourne at the time, and I had to sit down in the office with the social worker. And
was that because in case you had some kind of an emotional breakdown?
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, obviously there are, you know, people who were adopted who were the result of violent encounters, let's say. And, you know, if something traumatic had been in the file, their judgment was that, you know, you might need immediate support to cope with things that you had read that would have been completely unexpected and maybe shocking. And, you know, it's not for them to decide who might fit that description, who wouldn't. It's just their policy. That's just how it worked.
So once you opened that file, one of the first documents to come out was a newspaper article from the 1950s. Tell me what was in that newspaper article.
Well, there were two newspaper articles, which were reports of the divorce case between my biological mother and her, at that stage, estranged husband. And one of them was headed, "Come to Orgy, Wife Said to Friend."
Oh, my God.
And it then went on to relate that my biological mother, who by this stage had moved out of the marital home and was living in a block of flats in a village called Staines, which is not far away from London's Heathrow Airport. It's on the banks of the Thames. She was living in this block of flats with her parents and her two young children. There were four trainee BOAC pilots in the flat immediately below them. And she wrote to one of her friends, Paula, saying, "You should get a load of the boys downstairs. They're all pilots. They're all gorgeous. They have the most fabulous orgies. And the last one I went to, I didn't get home from until 5 a.m. And I suspect that that was the one that resulted in me. And the article then went on to describe various allegations that Margaret and Bill made about each other, bearing in mind, of course, that in those days, the only way you could get a divorce was by establishing bad behaviour on the part of one of the parties to the marriage, usually either cruelty or violence or infidelity or both. And so, you know, this was all argued out in front of court, and this was salacious gossip that helped sell newspapers. And so, you know, the story related that Margaret had had a relationship with another man, and that resulted in a baby who was now in foster care. And, you know, having read that story, I thought, oh, gee, my media career started a little earlier than I had realised. Although it obviously didn't mention me by name, but there was another article which said something similar. And then there was other material in the file that related to some subsequent circumstances, subsequent to my birth, and, you know, correspondence and notes taken by social workers who were handling my case, and various other bits of correspondence that all helped put the puzzle together.
So, Saul, you discovered that your birth mother had been married to Bill, who's listed on your birth certificate as your father. They'd already had two kids before you. Then they'd separated acrimoniously. She'd taken on a flat where there were BOAC, British Airways pilots, in the flat below who were often having, in her words, orgies, marvellous orgies downstairs. And that's how it seems she had become pregnant with you. So what clues did the article have about your mother, Margaret, becoming pregnant with you?
Well, the articles didn't say a great deal. I found out what I now know from other things that were in the file, and in particular from the records of the protracted divorce case that Margaret and Bill went through. What emerged from all of this was that when she found she was pregnant, Margaret asked her doctor for a termination. And according to her doctor's testimony at the divorce case, she expressed feelings of hatred for the child that she was carrying. The doctor said, no, that's illegal. You can't do that. She then asked for me to be induced earlier than normally would have occurred. And that was because the story she told was that in March of 1957, her estranged husband, Bill, had somehow climbed through the window of the apartment in which she was living after she had taken a sleeping pill and had, in the words of the day, taken advantage of her. Her doctor said, no, the child you're carrying wasn't conceived in March 1954. I'm not going to induce an early birth. So I turned up at the end of January 1958 in accordance with nature's ordinary schedule, and Margaret gave me up for adoption the day that I was born. I don't know whether she even looked at me or anything, but she gave me up the day that I was born, and I was put into foster care somewhere not far away from Heathrow Airport. And as I said before, Margaret put her estranged husband down as my father, whereupon he insisted that I be given some blood tests, which in those days were capable of proving that he wasn't my biological father. And he went to court to have his name removed from my birth certificate. And it was only after that that Margaret confessed that it was the pilot what done it, as it were. And she then named my biological father, Norman, and the social workers contacted him. And he said that he could well be the father of the baby. And he apparently went to have a look at me, the foster carer, and volunteered to pay a bit over £1 a week towards my foster care. But the law at the time presumed that if a married woman had a child, her husband must be its father. And therefore, although Bill Kimberley had gone to great lengths to prove I wasn't his son, he nonetheless sought to withhold the consent to my adoption that the law required at the time in order to extract a better financial settlement out of the divorce case. Oh. And that went on for almost a year until the adoption agency handling my case went before a judge seeking an order to overturn that requirement of the law, at which point Bill Kimberley backed down and gave his consent, although there was a lot of correspondence in the files where Bill Kimberley was saying things about his wife that, you know, the least that could happen is I get some financial compensation for all I've been put through, you know, that sort of stuff. And that is actually why it took a year for my adoption to be formalised.
That's why it took a year.
Yeah, right.
So you were, as an infant, you were a kind of pawn in this awful acrimonious divorce.
As it turned out, I didn't know this until afterwards, my parents, that's my adoptive parents, had custody, if that's the right word, care of me from the time I was about 3 or 4 months old. But the formal adoption didn't take place until February of 1959 because, as I say, Bill Kimberley had been withholding the consent that the law at the time required. My actual biological father, Norman, had given his consent readily, not that it was legally required, but that was part of the thing. And, you know, the acrimony between Margaret and her first husband went on for years. You know, the last piece of paper in the file that I have of their divorce proceedings was in 1969, when they were still fighting over whether my older half-sister should be allowed to go on an exchange program to Italy when she was in her last year of high school or something like that. So it's a wonder that they actually ever managed to have 2 children, given the things they said about each other during the divorce case. They accused each other of multiple incidents of adultery and of various types of violence. Ironically, Bill, after they got divorced, married the friend of Margaret's to whom she had written that letter.
The orgy letter.
They were married for a couple of years, and then obviously that didn't work. And then he married another Margaret, his third wife. But it also, you know, transpired from the files that Bill had maintained his rage for the rest of his life, that he made it his business to know in minute detail everything that Margaret subsequently did, including her subsequent marriages, the 3 more children she had after me, the fact that she had gone to jail twice for financial fraud, and, you know, where she was living. He made it his business to keep track of that for the rest of his life.
Saul, you had grown up suspecting that the reason it had taken so long for you to be adopted was because you were somehow unbecoming, you were short-sighted or something was not appealing about you. And now you find out the real reason is because you, as a kind of a helpless infant, was just simply being caught up in the nasty little hypocrisies of the 1950s. How did that make you feel to realise that?
Well, it explains things. I don't feel there's any point in feeling bitterness towards any of these things. I find it hard to judge which of Margaret or Bill was the more unsavoury.
But what about relief, though? I mean, was there some relief in that?
Yes, there was. Although, you know, I think by that stage I'd well and truly concluded that, you know, whatever things there might have been about me as an infant weren't really relevant to who I had become. And so I didn't give that a lot of thought. I mean, you know, I don't make judgments about the things that people did. I don't even really resent the fact that my biological mother's first reaction to discovering that she was carrying me was to inquire about a termination. That's what lots of people probably thought at the time. And you try and think, in her position, that thought would have at least passed my mind. I'm glad it didn't happen. I'm very glad she gave me up for adoption because all the accounts of her other children suggest that I was much more fortunate not to be brought up by her than the other 5 were.
So while Margaret was entangled with the divorce proceedings, what did you discover had happened to your real father, Norman, the pilot?
Well, he subsequently married an air hostess who I assume he'd met, a flight attendant who I assume he'd met in the ordinary course of business. They went on to have 3 sons. Now, I knew his name. I found out just by looking up certificates that he had died in 1995 of bowel cancer just before his 65th birthday, and that his death certificate had his address on it and the name of his widow. And I didn't do anything with that for a while. Then about 2 or 3 years later, I decided to write to her.
What did you write to her? Because I imagine that opening sentence is enormously important.
It is. So I wrote to her saying, what I'm about to write will probably come as a surprise, if not a shock to you, and that's not my intention. But long before you met your late husband, he had a brief relationship with another woman, which resulted in me. And I then went on to say, I'm not making any claim on you. I'm not wanting to intrude into your life, but I would like to know if you're willing to tell me, what was he like? Do I have any half-siblings? And did he have any medical conditions that I might want to know about?
And did she write back?
No. No, she didn't. And I left that for a while. And then after there'd been a whole slew over Christmas, New Year, one year, I think it might have been about 2009, episodes of Who Do You Think You Are? And I thought, yeah, there are aspects of my story probably more interesting than some of these. So I actually rang her up because, you know, you can look up British phone numbers fairly easily in those days. You could look through the British version of the White Pages and find a phone number if it was listed, which it was. So I rang up and I said, hello, I'm Saul Eastlake from Australia. And the line went dead. And I thought, well, maybe the line dropped out. So I rang back again and said I was, and she said, you're no relative of mine, and slammed the phone down. Then, after thinking about it a bit, I contacted the vicar in the village where she was living and described the situation and said, you know, is this person part of your flock? And he contacted back saying, yes, she was part of his flock. Did you also know that they had three sons, two of whom were pilots, and one actually lives in Australia? And so I put a post on a website called Professional Pilots Rumour Network, or PPRUN, which...
Sorry, Professional Pilots Rumour Network. That was a thing, right?
Yeah. Now, I knew about that because I had previously run across it after I had publicly complained about some poor service from Jetstar. So I posted on there saying, you know, does anyone on here know anything about a pilot? And, you know, I put his full name on there, who flew for BOAC and then for BA in the 1950s and 60s. It was my biological father. And quite a few people wrote back saying that they'd flown with him and that he was a very skilled pilot who'd executed some difficult landings. But then someone propped up who described himself as M. Mouse, saying, I can tell you some things about Norman, but before I do that, I'd like you to take down the references to him having had a relationship, because that could potentially be embarrassing to his family. So I said, sure. And it turns out that M. Mouse was my half-brother on that side, Michael, who, you know, was also a pilot. And he then said, if you want to know what your father looked like, look in the mirror. And I shortly after that, I met up with him in Edinburgh on a work trip to the UK, and he and his wife met me and he showed me some photos, and I do look like him. And Michael and his wife have been very welcoming and accepting, and we correspond from time to time. And as I say, I've met most of the half siblings on my biological mother's side as well.
That was very kind of Mike.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Let's go back to your mother, Margaret. Was she alive and contactable once you realised who she was?
The adoption agency told me that she was alive, she was no longer living in the UK, and saw no point in contact at this late stage. She had had arthritis, but no other health conditions.
Does that mean she didn't want to see
you?
Yes,
it does. It did. And what I subsequently learned from my older half-sister, Jane, is that when she was contacted, she rang up Jane, my older half-sister, and said, what do I do? And Jane said, well, what do you want to do? And she said, well, I don't want any contact. And she said, well, tell them that. So that's what she did. And Jane subsequently told me, after I'd met her the first time, that Biomother had had a stroke. And in Jane's opinion, and Jane was a nurse, so she would be in a better position to judge this than me. In Jane's opinion, if I, you know, kind of all of a sudden turned up and say, hello, remember me, that might have induced another stroke. And I didn't want to do that. You know, I suppose, despite knowing all that I know about her, I had held out the hope that at some point she might change her mind. I'd said to Jane that if she ever judged that she had changed her mind, I'd like to write her a letter saying, thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me up for adoption, because I've had a good life. If you hadn't done both of those things, maybe I wouldn't have had.
Yes, but what about your half-siblings? What kind of childhood did they have growing up with Margaret, your biological mother?
Well, they all had difficult upbringings. The older two, Stephen and Jane, were in effect brought up by their grandparents. You know, Margaret, in effect, abandoned them, and her parents brought them up. And then she subsequently married, you know, using a false name at her wedding. She was calling herself Margaret Kennedy when she married her second husband. She had three children, two boys and a girl, with them. None of them have anything complimentary to say about her skills as a parent. And all of them left home as soon as they possibly could. The youngest one, Justin, she put into a home when he was about 14 or 15, and he had a very difficult life as a result of things that happened to him there. Although, you know, in the last 20 years, he's picked up the pieces, established a career. All of us, all six of us, have had some, in different ways, unstable personal lives, you know, multiple marriages, that sort of thing. My two half-sisters have chosen not to have children. I don't know, and I've never asked, whether that was because of their own experiences, but all of them had parts of their childhoods were unsettled. And that's why I say, of all six of us, I was the most fortunate, because Margaret had nothing to do with my life.
You mentioned that Margaret, after the divorce, had spent some stints in jail. Did you find out why she'd been sent to jail?
No, not in detail. My understanding, it was for some kind of financial fraud. She worked as a legal secretary, and one of the stories related to me by one of my half-siblings was that she used to use the knowledge she acquired as a legal secretary to find out the names of people who had died intestate, and then change her name and claim to be a long-lost relative and make a claim upon the estate. I did employ someone in England to see if they could track down court records or newspaper articles describing this. It didn't lead anywhere. We couldn't find anything. My younger half-sister said she can remember her father telling her that Mum was going away for a long holiday. And she didn't really know quite what that meant, but some other kids in her school knew about it and teased her about, you know, Mum spending time at Holloway or whichever prison that she spent some time in. Her second marriage survived the first stint in jail, but not the second. They got divorced after that, and then she subsequently married a French guy, and they remained together for the rest of her life. She passed away in April of last year.
Do you have a sense of her personality? Does she fit the profile of a typical fraudster, someone who's gregarious, charming, persuasive, all those things?
I don't know. I don't know enough about her, and you know, my half-siblings don't really claim to know her all that well either. You know, they only met intermittently. I mean, she lived outside the UK for a great deal of her life. She lived in France. She lived in Portugal. She lived for the last 5 years or so of her life in the very south of Spain amongst an expatriate British community down there. So there wasn't a lot of contact with them. They all say that she was difficult. They all say that she told them lies, that she was difficult to get on with, difficult to believe. So I was lucky that she didn't have anything to do with my life.
What picture do you have of her early life, the circumstances that led her to become the woman she became?
Well, she was born in the late 1920s and grew up in the East End of London. Her father had been Jewish and renounced his faith in order to marry a woman from a Protestant and somewhat more affluent background from Middlesex. He ran a fruit and vegetable stall in Covent Garden. And like people in that position, he wanted a son who would carry on that business. Instead, his first child was a daughter. And my understanding is that there were complications associated with her birth, which meant that her mother couldn't have any more children. So I think Margaret probably grew up sensing that she was somehow resented. She was sent away from the home during the Blitz, as a lot of kids apparently were in the 1940s when the Germans were dropping bombs on the East End of London on a nightly basis. And I don't know to what extent she became estranged from her own parents, although, as I said before, she went back to live with them after her first marriage fell apart. She was married at the age of 19, and I assume that, you know, that marriage was an escape from a situation she found difficult at home. Bill Kimberley was, I think, 9 or 10 years older than her. He was named after his uncle who had died heroically at Flanders during World War I. And I think he was expected to live up to the heroic deeds of his namesake. Bill Kimberley did serve in World War II, but I don't think anything notable happened during that time. And so the two of them were both, as far as I can tell, scarred by their childhood or other experiences, and in particular, perhaps by a sense that they hadn't been able to live up to the expectations that their respective parents had for them. And that's, you know, partly, I suppose, why I try not to be too judgmental about what they did with the rest of their lives.
You began this journey 2 decades ago at a moment when you realized you'd never met a blood relative. Now it sounds like you know, I don't know, a dozen or so blood relatives or thereabouts. And I wonder what it's like as a man in the second half of his life to at last meet people, a whole lot of people you're biologically related to, and see yourself, something of yourself, in their faces.
I've got 8 half-siblings, biological half-siblings, in addition to the 3 siblings I grew up with. I've met 5 of those half-siblings and spoken to 6 of them. There's one older brother on my biological mother's side who I haven't met, although I've corresponded with and spoken to a couple of times over the phone. There are 2 on my biological father's side that I haven't met. One of them has made it clear he doesn't want to meet me, and that's fine. That's his choice. It's not as if he could tell me anything about my biological father that Mike hasn't told me or that I haven't figured out myself. But there is something that, to be honest, I find hard to describe, but there is something about meeting for the first time people with whom you share genes and bloodlines, if that's the right word. You know, and my adoptive siblings are my brother and sisters. I love them. They're the ones I grew up with. That's not the same as meeting my biological siblings, but I feel a closeness to them that is different from what I feel about my adoptive siblings.
Saul, you're well known as a real straight shooter. Can you see anything of yourself in your birth mother across that great chasm that separates you?
Oh, well, I don't want to portray myself as a saint or people to think of me as a saint. You know, I've made mistakes in my personal life and done some bad things and, you know, not committed any crimes or anything, but done things that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you say, geez, I wish I hadn't done that or hadn't said that. Occasionally, some people might say, is that your mother coming out in you? As I say, there are some physical resemblances to both of them. By all accounts, Norman, my biological father, was a good man. He was good at his job. He was a good father. He was a good friend. He was a good man. And, you know, I wish I knew more about him than I do. Mike has told me a fair bit, some of his friends. I actually did manage to track down one of the people who had been in the flat with him at Staines. And he, again, spoke so warmly about Norman as a good man and as a good friend. He said that at the time, Norman was worried that he might lose his job because at that time, BOEC was a government-owned corporation and they probably had fairly conservative personal policies. So he was a bit worried about that. As I say, he would have been told by the social workers who were handling my case, you know, to forget this ever happened and get on with the rest of your life, which is presumably what he did. As far as I know, he never told his wife or any of his 3 sons that he had with her anything about me. And, you know, that would have been something difficult for them to process when, you know, because of me, they found out about it.
So Margaret died in 2025. If you had been able to meet her in person, what would you have wanted her to know?
That I was grateful that she had me, knowing that she considered not doing it, and that I was especially grateful that she gave me up for adoption, because thanks to my adoptive parents, have had a fabulous life that I wouldn't otherwise have had. And she made that possible by giving me up. I guess what I kind of want to do by being able to talk about this is to put a positive side to adoption. I mean, I know that there were a lot of women in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s who were forced to give up their babies against their will. And they're tragic stories, and it's right and proper that Australia, like other countries and state governments, have apologised to those women who were forced to give up their babies by the standards of the day, and to the children who were deprived of contact with their biological parents. Those stories are tragedies. But there are also positive adoption stories. Parents who had families that they wouldn't otherwise have had and had the opportunity to nurture and show love to children who perhaps otherwise wouldn't have received it, and kids who had better lives than they otherwise would have had. You know, every story is different in some way, but my story, and I hope, and when they come to think about it, my kids will have positive stories to tell compared with what the alternative might have been.
It's an amazing story, Saul, and I really thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you, Richard.
Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Gadigal and Muwinina peoples. Producer is Jennifer Leake. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.